And tonight we want to address the problem of evil. The arguments that are made by our atheistic friends as they talk about the problem of evil that it presents, they think, for us. I want to begin with this note. The evidence that we have presented thus far becomes a peg that we hold on to. And what I mean by that simply is this, that we always come back to my peg. When I am looking at any controversial subject, I study and look at what the Bible teaches on that subject. Let's forget about evidences for a moment and talk about Bible subjects. And suppose the subject is a matter of baptism. Is it essential to salvation? I first of all drive down a peg. And that peg is what I keep coming back to. For example, Mark 16:16 is the peg that I would come back to. I know, no matter what anybody says, that baptism is essential because that's the peg I have to hold to. And so I always come back to my peg. I may face questions and arguments I don't know how to answer. So when you talk to somebody who is brushed up on their arguments about baptism not being essential, and they offer you something you've never heard of, they offer some argument from the Greek, and you say, I don't even know what you're talking about. Or they make the argument about the second person plural and the third person singular in Acts 2:38, and therefore you can't use that passage, they argue. Or whatever arguments that they may use about the Holy Spirit falling upon the household of Cornelius, when you get through with all of that, you have to come back to your peg. You say, I don't know how to answer some of those questions. I don't know what the answer to that is. I know there is an answer, but I don't know what it is. I don't let it shake my faith because I keep coming back to my peg that's been driven down hard that I hold to. Well, the same thing is true when it comes to the matter of evidence for the existence of God. Keep coming back to your peg. And that is, we have driven down some pegs that I know there is a God. How do I know? We've looked at the argument for a cause, just like the arguments from creation that is made in Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, Psalm 19. There's argument from a designer. And then in our last study, we talked about the moral argument and the universal belief in God. And at least four major arguments for the existence of God. That's not all that can be given, but we're just giving the thumbnail description of the arguments that can be given. Now, when I have my familiarity with those arguments, for example, the uncaused first cause, I come back to that peg. The atheist may raise a question I don't know how to answer. They may raise an argument I'm not sure what the response is. But I can always come back to that peg that I know there is a God. How do I know? Because I know there is an uncaused first cause. I know that there is a designer. I know the moral code argues for the existence of God. And on down the line, we might go. The atheist argues saying that there is no evidence for God. And you may talk to an atheist, or you may have a professor, you may have a teacher, you may have a friend who will argue saying, there is no evidence for God. And therefore, I don't believe in God. Well, that's not so, because we have given evidence thereof of that, and we've talked about that in the past two studies. But I want to suggest to you that the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. That is, because someone thinks there is no evidence here, that does not argue for the evidence of the absence of God. And what I'm trying to suggest to you is that there is the burden of proof on the part of the atheist and the agnostic, that he needs to present more than the absence of evidence. But they must present some positive evidence that there is no God. And we're going to challenge some of their evidence in as our study continues. Let's talk about the problem of evil. Let's begin by looking at the atheist argument. This is one of the arguments that they make. Here's how their argument goes. If evil exists, then there is, in their mind, they say, no God. Here's how their argument flows. Let's just get their argument down. If God is an omnipotent, that is, an all-powerful God, He would be able to eliminate all evil because there is no limit to what He could do. Now, that's what the atheist argues. I won't bore you with quotations from atheists, whether they be Mr. Flew or Mr. Mackey or whoever it may be, that have written much on the concept, David Hume, and others who have written much on the concept of there is no God. But they argue from the standpoint that if God is omnipotent and all-powerful, He'll be able to eliminate all evil because He's the all-powerful God. There is no limit to what He could do. Secondly, if God is omnibenevolent, that is, all good and all loving, He would not desire that evil exist. So if the God that you serve, the God of your Bible, is an all-loving God, an all-benevolent God, He doesn't want any evil to exist. Furthermore, the argument says, a good, all-powerful God would eliminate evil. Evil exists. That is, human suffering, animal cruelty, natural disasters, evil exists. Thus, there is no God. Because if there is a God, He would eliminate all evil. Because He's all good. He doesn't want any evil. And if He doesn't want any evil, He's all powerful. He can eliminate all evil. And if evil exists, then there is, therefore, no God. Epicurus, in 300 B.C., that's long before, that's during that intertestament period, telling you, I want to remind you what that date is talking about. We're talking about before Christ. Epicurus, in 300 A.D., so argued. He presented a logical contradiction in his mind between belief in God and the presence of evil. Here's what he said. The gods can either take away evil from the world and will not, or being willing to do so cannot. Or they neither can nor will, or lastly, they are both able and willing. If they have the will to remove evil and cannot, then they are not omnipotent. If they can and but will not, they are not benevolent. If they are neither able nor willing, they are neither omnipotent nor benevolent. Lastly, if they are both able and willing to annihilate evil, how does it exist? See, this is an old argument. We're going back long before, even the time of Christ, they were arguing there is no God on the basis that evil indeed exists. Now, I want to talk about, before we begin to answer that argument, let's talk about the apologist assessment. Now, what do I mean by the apologist assessment? An apologist is one who is giving defense of, we are apologists, we're supposed to be, 1 Peter 3:15. I'm an apologist, you are, but I'm talking about those who have written much on in the field of apology or in the field of evidence, their assessment of the nature of this argument. And I'm trying to accomplish this by so quoting these men. The point I want you to see is that this argument is one of the strongest arguments that the atheists have made. If it can be answered, and I think it can, then their toughest arguments can be answered. That's what I want you to see. I want to give you the assessment of, quote, unquote, some professional apologists who are dealing much with this in the public arena and have in the past dealt with it. What is their assessment? If this is a real tough argument and this is one of their strongest arguments and it can be answered, then we can answer the strongest and the toughest of arguments. If you look at this and you say, if this is the best they have and it can be answered, they really don't have much. And the truth of the matter is, the atheists don't have a lot of arguments to make. There are some arguments they offer, but there's not a lot that they do offer. They don't give much evidence. There's a lot of assumptions. We'll talk about some assumptions even in our study tonight. Now, here's some assessments of what this argument is and how strong it may be. William Lane Craig, in his book On Guard, an excellent book on apologetics, said, paradoxically, then even though the problem of suffering is the greatest objection to the existence of God, at the end of the day, it's the only solution to the problem of suffering. We'll come back to that quote a little bit later. But his assessment is it's one of the greatest objections. This is one of their strongest arguments. Bethel Barrett Baxter, many of you are familiar with that name. And I believe because, book, he said, one of the most difficult is the question, how could a God of infinite goodness create a world with so much evil in it? He said, that's one of the greater difficulties we have to wrestle with. We've got to wrestle with the problem of evil and the problem of suffering. Paul Little, in the book, Know Why You Believe, said this, this is one of the most pressing questions of our time. More pressing than the question of miracles. Or science in the Bible is the problem of why innocent people suffer, why babies are born blind, or why promising life is snuffed out as it's on the rise. Or why there are wars in which thousands of innocent people are killed and children are burned beyond recognition and many are maimed for life. That's a difficult question, he says. Thomas B. Warren, in his excellent book, Have Atheists Proved There Is No God? It is likely, by the way, he debated a number of the atheists over the years, and that was kind of his specialty in the field of apologetics. He said, it is likely the case that no charge has been made with greater frequency or with more telling force against theism of the Judeo-Christian biblical tradition than that such theism is unable to explain adequately the occurrence or the existence of evil. Perhaps you've been asked that question. Now, I want to suggest to you, as we continue, the apologist assessment of this, and that is that it's a major argument they make. And what I wanted you to see from that the apologists are saying, this is one of their stronger arguments. And if we can give a sufficient answer to that argument to show they have not proven there is no God, then their strongest of arguments can be dealt with. It tells me their arguments are not that strong. They haven't presented a problem we have to grapple with and we wrestle with and we can't figure it out. But I want to suggest to you that for many this problem is an emotional thing. Some approach the existence of God from an intellectual problem and the problem of suffering from an intellectual problem, where they try to analyze and theorize that if there is a God and there is evil, they can't both exist. But I want to give you this quotation from William Lane Craig in On Guard. He said, "I'm convinced that for most people, the terrible suffering in the world is really an emotional, not an intellectual problem. Their unbelief is born not out of refutation, but out of rejection. They just want nothing to do with a God that would allow them and others to suffer terribly." You see what he's saying? That for many people who say, "I don't believe in God," why do you not believe in God? Because there's so much evil in the world. It is born out of a rejection concept. It is an emotional issue for them. And I don't want to have anything to do with a God that allows men to suffer, rather than an intellectual problem. That I've looked at the evidence and there is no evidence that indeed there is a God. Let's spend the rest of our time in what I call a reasonable response. We've looked at the atheist argument. We've looked at the apologist assessment of that argument. But I want us to talk about a reasonable response. How do we respond to the problem of evil? Well, there are a number of things we want to say. So let's work methodically through this if we can. I want us to begin by noticing that man is not in a position to assess all the probabilities about suffering. We certainly are just not in a position wherein we can give a complete assessment of all that's going on with reference to suffering. It is hopeless for the finite being, such as we are, to consider all the probabilities with confidence. We can't do that. No one, so said Wayne Jackson in his work Surveying the Evidence, should be so presumptuous as to assert that man can completely understand the problem of suffering. There's not an atheist around who says, "I completely understand the problem of suffering." At least he can't do that. Nor is there a theist around who said, "I completely understand all the matters of suffering." And I'll tell you why we say that here in just a moment. We will not and we cannot answer all questions with reference to suffering. But please be advised that that does not mean that we cannot have any answers at all. That doesn't mean I don't have any answers to the problem. I can't answer all questions. And I'll tell you why that's true in just a moment. But that doesn't mean I don't have any answers or that erases the existence of God. I go back to my peg. That I know there is a God. How do I know there is a God? Because of the uncaused first cause. I know it because of the designer. Because of the moral argument and the universal belief in God. Those four points that we've been talking about thus far. I want to suggest to you, and here's why I said this a minute ago, that man is limited in his knowledge of what God is doing and why he's doing that. Let me give you an example of that. Joseph was sold into Egypt. Now you think about Joseph when he was sold by his brothers and he's put down in the pit and some Ishmaelite traders come by and they sell him to the Ishmaelite traders and they take him off to Egypt and he sells him to Potiphar. At that moment, from that vantage point, Joseph was done evil. He has to think this is an evil thing. This is a terrible thing that I was treated this way. I've been sold by my brothers. I've been lied about. And I am separated from my family for who knows how long. Maybe forever. But what I want to suggest to you is that God was working out His plan and His providence to spare His people. Baxter observes that perhaps life needs to be read like Hebrew. Hebrew, unlike English, is read backwards. And we need to read life backwards. Meaning that you take the life of Joseph, and once now I see what happened to Joseph, and his being there caused God to spare his people from in Egypt, and able to take care of his people in Egypt, then I can read backwards and see God's hand in working in getting him there to Egypt. Not that God caused it, but God allowed it. And so when the question is arise, why does God cause suffering? Or why does God allow suffering? I may not understand. I can't explain it all. What I'm trying to say is I'm not in a position, nor is anyone, to deal with all the probabilities of suffering. I can look at some of that backwards, like in the life of Joseph. But if I didn't know the end of the story, I'd think this is a terrible thing, and it was an evil thing. So why does evil exist? Well, God allowed some evil to take place that He might bring about some good in the case of Joseph. Now let's shift gears and talk about how the burden of proof must be upon the atheist. The burden of proof is upon the atheist. What we simply mean by that, when we talk about the burden of proof, that the atheist must show and demonstrate his argument. What proof is there that evil and God cannot exist? The atheist asserts that if evil exists, God does not exist. If God exists, evil does not exist. You can't have both at the same time. The burden of proof becomes upon the atheist. What proof is there that God and evil cannot coexist? They haven't presented any. They make the affirmation. In fact, here's another thing about the burden of proof upon the atheist. They must explain how evolution worked in the evolution of the idea of a benevolent God came from an environment of all matter, all material universe. They believe that everything came from matter. And how did the idea of a benevolent God that we have come from that? That's hard for them to explain. The burden of proof is upon them. Now, this is important to get the rest of the study. The argument of the atheist, one of their strongest arguments, assumes two things. Those of you who've heard me talking about how to answer religious error, always watch for assumptions. Always watch for assumptions. The atheists make many assumptions. They assume two things. Here's the first. They assume that if God is all-powerful, He can create any world He wants. I don't believe that. I don't think you do either. You stop and think about that. They are assuming that if God is all-powerful, He can create any world He wants. Second assumption. We'll come back to that one. They secondly assume that if God is all-loving, He prefers a world without suffering. I don't believe that. I don't believe you do either. Now, those are two assumptions that the atheists have made, and that's going to be the rest of our study, focusing on those two assumptions. Is the fact that God is an all-powerful God mean He can create any world that He wants? And is the fact that He's an all-loving, all-good, and all-benevolent God mean that He prefers a world without suffering? We have to deal with that. We have to grapple with that if we're going to answer the atheist. And let's see if we can do that. If God created man with free will, which He did, and even the atheists have to recognize we have free will. We're not robots. We are not created or evolved, if we want to use their term. We did not evolve into a creature that is programmed to only do one thing, and we cannot make a choice to do good or bad. They will recognize that I have the choice either to kill him or to spare his life, to love him or to hate him. We have free will. If God created free will in man, then God cannot eliminate all evil. If man has free will, he has the ability to choose. Stop and think about that. If man has free will, man has the ability to choose. You cannot have free will and eliminate bad choices, which involve evil. You can't have that. God cannot create a man and did not create a man that is given free will, but then he cannot choose to do evil. Then that's not free will. That's contradictory. There must be consequences to choosing evil. If man is given free will, Romans 6 argues for free will. Man has a choice. There must be consequences to choosing evil. It is not possible to eliminate all evil as long as there's free will. That can't be done. Now get this point. We're talking about impossibilities. Some say that if God is the all-powerful God, He can create any world He wants. He can create man with a free will, and yet there's no evil. No, He can't. No, He can't do that. I'll tell you something else cannot be done. God cannot create a round square. God cannot make a four-sided triangle. God cannot make a ball that is all white and all black at the same time. God cannot create a rock that's too heavy for He Himself to lift. Now, why is that? I want to suggest to you that Tom Warren suggests in his work on the Atheists Prove There Is No God that we need to quit talking about what is not possible for God and just talk about what is not possible. That is, here's the point of what's not possible. It is not possible to have free will and eliminate evil at the same time. That's an impossibility. It's not that God can't do that. It's the fact that it can't be done. And it's not that merely God cannot create a round square. That's impossible to make. A four-sided triangle is impossible. An omnipotent God, an all-powerful God, can do anything that is possible. But making a four-sided triangle is impossible. So it's not that our God is limited and is doesn't have power. It just simply means that's something that cannot be done. In fact, the Bible talks in Hebrews 6 and verse 18, it's impossible for God to lie. Even the Bible presents some impossibilities for God. There's some things impossible for God. So we're talking about possibilities and impossibilities here. Now, man, while we're talking about free will, I want to suggest to you that man misuses his free will. And therefore he suffers, and therefore evil comes. Let me give you two illustrations. One is, here's a woman marries a sorry man. And that's happened, and we've seen that happen. Here's some woman that she's dating a man that's a drunkard, and he's a drug addict, and we warn, and we warn, and we warn, and say, don't marry him, there's nothing but trouble. And she marries him, and she's beaten by him, she suffers at his hands, she may even be killed at his hands. Now, she misused her freedom. She has free will. She could choose to marry him or not marry him, but she abused that to the point now she suffers because of that. That was her free choice. Now, there's also free will. Here's a man who decides he's going to get drunk, and he decides to drive, and he crosses the line, and he injures himself, and he injures someone else, and maybe kills both of you. Because of free will, there is going to be suffering. Now, you can't eliminate evil if there is free will. It just can't be eliminated. And so if God created man with a free will, we cannot eliminate all evil. It's impossible to eliminate that. And so the atheist is making that assumption. Remember their assumption that we talked about. But let's consider this further. C.S. Lewis is one of the most noted apologists of the last 100 years or so. He said, some people think they can imagine a creature which was free, but had no possibility of going wrong. I cannot. If a thing is free to be good, it is also free to be bad. And free will is what makes evil possible. Why? Then did God give free will? Because free will, though it makes evil possible, is also the only thing that makes possible any love, goodness, or joy worth having. I say, amen. Now let's raise the question, why does God permit suffering? There is no evidence that God causes suffering, but God does permit it or allow it. So why is there suffering? Well, let's analyze that from several angles. Some suffering is brought on by free choice, by free will choice on ourselves and others, as we just illustrated. We could stop at that point and we've answered the question. Why does God permit suffering? Well, it gave us free will. Even the atheists admit we have free will. And you can't have free will without there being some wrong choices. So I may make a wrong choice, and therefore I suffer. I decide to walk on the ice when I shouldn't have walked on the ice, and I fall down and I get injured. My neighbor decides to drive while he's drunk, and I get injured because of his drunk driving. Some suffering comes because of human free will. Suffering seems pointless and puzzling if we assume, here's another assumption, that God's purpose for man is happiness in life. The atheist has to assume that if there is a God and God created man, he created man to be happy. And you won't find that in the pages of the Old or New Testament, either one. That seems pointless. Life seems pointless. Suffering seems pointless. What's the point of suffering and God allowing that since God created man to be happy? There's no evidence that God just created man that he might just be happy. That's the goal. I want to suggest to you that God's purpose is not limited to this life. Quite often it spills over heavily into the eternal life. Let me give you an example. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Then we'll come back to chapter 4. Turn over to 2 Corinthians. Paul is defending himself in 2 Corinthians about why he does what he does. And things that he has endured. It's the most self-focused book of any that he has written. But I want you to notice in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, some of the things that he endured. Reminds us of chapter 11 of 2 Corinthians, but I want to focus at chapter 6. He talks about how he was in stripes in verse 5. I went back up to verse 4. That in much patience and tribulations they were in need and in distress and in stripes and imprisonments and tumults and in labors and sleeplessness and fasting and purity and in knowledge and long-suffering and kindness. Here are a number of things that he endured. There was much suffering that he went through. But notice his attitude about that in chapter 4 and verse 17. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far exceeding and eternal weight of glory. You see the point that he's making? That God's purposes are not limited to this life, but they spill over heavily into the life that is beyond. The problem, Craig says, for the atheist becomes even more acute when we reflect that perhaps there wasn't any earthly reason at all why God permitted those catastrophes. Maybe they serve no earthly good whatsoever. The atheist can only focus on life here on earth because he doesn't believe in an eternity beyond, and he thinks that everything is limited to this life. Some of the things that may be allowed for us to suffer may not have any purpose whatsoever in this life. It may have something about the life beyond. To say they serve no purpose requires a probability judgment way beyond our ability. There may be a larger picture that we don't see. I take care of you back to Joseph. He said, what good purpose could there be in his brother selling him off into Egypt? Well, if that's all we saw, but when I get the broader picture, then I get a better picture of what's going on, that why God did allow that. And maybe the same is going on even in our own time. Can good come from suffering? Let's see. It might be that pain that you experience sends you to the doctor for a treatment or a cure. Have you ever doubled over with pain? Thought you were dying, go to the doctor, and he quickly did surgery and saved your life. Sometimes pain's good. The outcome is good. One of the illustrations that some of the apologists have given is like a mother deer, or maybe it's a mother cow, that comes charging at you or some other animal to protect its young. It may cause suffering. I've witnessed that. I stayed in a home during a meeting where a woman took her grandchildren out to see the calf, and the mother cow took out after the grandmother and charged her and ran over her and left her laying there in our eyesight. It caused pain and suffering for the rest of her life. She was somewhat disabled for the rest of her life. Now, that was this mother cow who was charging to protect her young, and she did that to cause suffering and pain, and yet the survival of the young deer or the young cow or the calf is essential for the protection of our food chain. Because if the mother had no way of protecting her young, then those young would be completely destroyed. Pain and suffering sometimes is good. Would you like to eliminate all bee stings? This is part of what God told Job. Job, in essence, and I'm paraphrasing, Job, if you could change things, what would you do? And the bottom line is Job would mess it up. And we would too. He said, well, if I had control, I'd eliminate all bee stings, really. Because that's the only way they have of protecting their honey. You see, pain sometimes is productive of good. It makes us better. Let's turn to Romans chapter 5. Pain and suffering makes us better. It builds courage. It builds character. It builds patience. Look at Romans chapter 5. You know, so you wonder, why does God allow His own people to suffer sometimes? We read this morning. We know that we glory in tribulation, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope. It builds character within us. We go through the trial, we go through the tribulation, we go through suffering, we go through heartache. And it builds character. Tom Warren suggested in his book, Have Atheists Proved There Is No God? He argues repeatedly through the book for this point, and that is that man needs a challenging environment to make moral and spiritual decisions. You recognize that in raising your own children. That if there is no environment where they have to make choices, and sometimes the choice is wrong and therefore then they suffer because of it, then they cannot ever learn to formulate good decisions. Man needs a challenging environment to make moral and spiritual decisions. Well, what about the pain of animals? Well, pain causes the animal to cease.
or to diminish
the activity after it's been injured. That is very helpful in controlling the animal. That's also very helpful in the preserving of animal life. If there was no pain, if we had the ability, our God removed all pain from animals, can you imagine the difference in the animal life? Try to train your dog and there is no pain ever. He never feels any pain. Try to train your horse. Try to get that cow go up the chute. And try to prod him with that shock thing you have. No pain is not going to work. Provides food, the pain of animals that they endure, sometimes provides food and clothing for man. We use them as instruments for advancement of medical science. Can you imagine where we'd be in the medical science if we haven't done experiments on animals to see how things are done? I'm just trying to show you some value in suffering. All suffering cannot be eliminated. It's impossible to eliminate all suffering. And so this argument and this assumption that if God is a good, loving God, He cares and He's a loving God, He would eliminate all evil. He wants to eliminate all evil. I argue against that. Because we cannot eliminate all evil. If you can have an axe or a saw to cut a tree for man's good and for man's benefit, it's also possible to use that same thing on an animal or a man, wouldn't it? Is it that God, that means He didn't give us free will then? So if we have the ability to make an axe so I can cut a tree down, or a saw and I cut a tree down so that I could use the wood to heat my house, is it impossible if I tried to use that same axe on a dog to kill the dog, I couldn't kill the dog? Or maybe on a man, I couldn't kill the man? No, I have free will. If we take away the ability to do evil, we just took away the ability to do good. If we have water that we might drink and cook and have and bathe, it's possible to be used for drowning. We take away the possibility of drowning, we've taken away the water to drink and to cook and to bathe with. But what do we learn from suffering and from tragedy, calamities, and catastrophe? Two things I want to suggest to you. We learn two things. We learn that life on earth is brief. In other words, it's going to come to an end. So a tornado comes through and it wipes out half the town. And you say, what tragedy, what suffering. Tell you what we learn from that. We learn, if nothing else, we learn that life is brief and it comes to an end. Here's a second thing we learn, closely related. The time of death is uncertain. Hebrews 9 and verse 27. And all of that is designed, or at least could be used, to drive men to God. If not, why not? I want to suggest to you that sin is the only evil that is in the world. When our atheist friend talks about evil, our atheist friends talk about evil, and they talk about it repeatedly. And they talk about evil, and they mention human suffering, okay. They talk about animal cruelty, where one animal devours another animal, and that's evil. The lion devours the bear devours the lion, or the mountain lion comes after the dog and kills it, or whatever the case may be. And that's evil. A tornado comes through, that's evil. A storm blows your house down and a wildfire comes through. That's evil, they say. I want to suggest to you that sin is the only evil in the world. Nothing subhuman can do evil. Well, I know that from a biblical perspective. But I challenge the atheist who doesn't believe in the Bible, and that's not his standard, to show any kind of reasonable argumentation that shows that anything subhuman can do evil. Show me where animals can do evil. Animal suffering at the hand of other animals and natural calamity are not evil. So the very basis of the concept and the argument of the atheist is based upon a definition of evil that is contrary to any reasonable point of view. I want to suggest to you that the world has some underlying principles of regularity of law, what we might call natural law. Examples of this, Genesis 1 and 2 talks about everything produces after its kind. And so you have the dog and it reproduces a dog. You know, it'll have a dog and it reproduces, and next thing you know that the male and female dog has now had an elephant. That doesn't work. Everything reproduces after its kind. Same thing when you have corn, it produces corn. And you have beans, it reproduces after its kind. And that's a principle of regularity of law, natural law. Well, furthermore, Genesis 8 and verse 22, there's the seasons. There's regularity of law with reference to that. Now, I suggest all of that to tell you that the weather system that takes water from the oceans and draws it by evaporation and takes moisture to the mainlands sometimes may create a flood. sometimes may create a tornado. Those are principles of natural law. Those are not evil. It may cause destruction. There's nothing to say that that's evil. There is no reason to argue that that's evil. That's a natural regularity of law, or as some call it, natural law. Take gravity, for example. What would life be without gravity? You're thankful for gravity, but when you're on the top of a building and you start sliding off, the gravity may kill you. And so here is the regularity, our principle of regularity of law, our natural law, wherein there may be some suffering that comes from that. And even death, it may come from that. We cannot have the advantages of the regularity of law without having the disadvantages. And again, illustrate that with the matter of gravity. You can't have the advantages of gravity, keeping your feet on the ground rather than you're floating around, and at the same time not also have the danger of falling and being killed by that fall. You remove one, you've also removed the other. Now, I want to raise this question in answer to the problem of evil and suffering. Why doesn't evil prove there is a God? The atheists have presented to us because evil exists. And they have a broad definition of evil, broader than the Bible and broader than my definition. But let's take their definition of evil and broaden it out to encompass every kind of natural calamity, animal devouring animal, pain, suffering in the animal kingdom, etc. All of this evil exists. Man killing man. Man abusing man. And they say because evil exists, therefore there is no God. I want to know why that doesn't prove there is a God. And here's how. If God does not exist, then there is no objective moral values in the world. We talked about the moral law, the moral principle of man last time. So if God does not exist, there is no objective moral value in the world. Evil does exist by our atheist admission. Therefore, there is an objective moral value that exists because some things are evil by their own definition. Therefore, God exists. Why not? I want to ask the atheist who tells me the presence of evil says there is no God. If there is such a thing as evil, there is some moral standard. If there's a moral standard, there is a God. If not, why not? Furthermore, much of what the atheists say about this deals with God's character. I said it was an emotional thing. I started on that with a note from Craig. That much of those who argue from this argue from an emotional vantage point, not an intellectual vantage point, an emotional, that I don't want to have anything to do with a God that allows suffering. And what they're doing is they're dealing with God's character. This is a question, the question of our study tonight, has to do not with His character, it has to do with the existence of God. And what we've proven, there is a God. Now that God may allow evil. That God may allow suffering. We may need to talk about why He allows that suffering, and we have. We may need to talk about, is that in harmony with His character? But that doesn't tell us there is no God. It does not prove there is no God. So what have we seen in our study tonight? We've seen three things. The atheist argument, the apologist assessment of that argument. Their argument is, if God is all-powerful and God is all-loving, He would eliminate evil, and He could eliminate evil, but since evil exists, therefore He's either not all-benevolent or not all-powerful, therefore He does not exist. The apologists say that's one of the strongest arguments they've ever made. If that's it, then we can deal with their arguments, each and every one, whatever they may be. And we can face those arguments, and we've looked at a reasonable response to that. Let me close again with this quotation from Winland Craig in On Guard. Paradoxically, then even though the problem of suffering is the greatest objection to the existence of God, at the end of the day, the only solution, God is the only solution to the problem of suffering. They present suffering as the greatest objection against God, and yet God is the only answer to that suffering. Isn't that interesting? That's the only answer that we have. So the problem of suffering is turned to the Almighty God. We'll have another question and answer period as long as that interest continues. As we, those of you who have been going back to the young adult classroom after services, about 10 minutes after we dismiss, and try to answer some of the questions that someone may have. Now, some of the young people, their parents, and anyone who wants to come and ask any questions that have to do with evidences. There may be one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins. If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and while we sing?